Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why the U.S. and Mexico are in a trade dispute over genetically modified corn.
And our Last Resort series continues with a look at how health and wellness was used as a draw to the valley.
But first, crisis pregnancy centers have been around since the late 1960s. But in the increasingly fraught battle over reproductive rights in this country since the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, they're front and center. Crisis pregnancy centers offer free pregnancy and STD tests, ultrasounds and parenting classes, but they're controversial. In March, Democratic Attorney General Chris Mayes hit them with a consumer alert, calling them, quote, an obstacle hiding in plain sight for people considering abortion. There are 40-plus crisis pregnancy centers in Arizona. At the same time, there are just 9 licensed abortion providers here. Natasha Yee with the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting dove deep into it all, and I spoke with her more about it.
So crisis pregnancy centers offer free pregnancy tests and ultrasounds, among other services, but most are not licensed medical facilities and don't provide comprehensive reproductive health care. Mm-hmm. They are largely funded by individuals who just believe in their cause. They're also known as like anti-abortion centers or pregnancy resource centers. So they've been around since the 1960s, but in more recent years, and certainly since the Dobbs decision, which overturned Roe v. Wade, they've been more and more funded by public and state funding. So state and at the national level funding being poured into these centers.
Right. And I want to talk more about that landscape in a moment. But talk first a little bit more about who they serve. You found sort of in your analysis here in Arizona that they're often targeting kind of low income communities of color.
Sure. Low income communities of color going into these spaces and saying, hey, we're here. We offer free pregnancy tests. We have ultrasounds, which is great. And so they certainly can be good resources for the community. Like in 2022, centers across the country, according to the Charlotte Lozier Institute, provided $367 million worth of goods and services at virtually no cost to clients. But the problem can occur when they can be misleading in that care because, again, most are not licensed medical facilities. You're not being seen by a doctor. And so they're limited in what they can do. Limited ultrasounds, you know, urine pregnancy tests. But if someone goes into a facility and doesn't know that that's the case, I think that's where the problem can lie. And according to Attorney General Mays, for example, issued a consumer alert back in March warning against the deceitful tactics. She called them in the alert an obstacle hiding in plain sight for those thinking about terminating their pregnancies. You know, she said they often portray themselves as medical clinics, but instead aim to discourage people from seeking abortion care and to persuade those seeking abortions not to access care.
Right. So you're getting at the big political divide that these centers are really at the center of right now. As you said, we've got conservative states, many that are bolstering them. They're expanding in post-Roe America. They're sometimes getting taxpayer state funding. And then, you know, you have people on the Democratic side like Chris Mayes, who you're talking about, who are going so far as to say these places are misleading. There's a consumer alert on them. Talk a little bit about what they say they do. Like, did they respond to you in your reporting here?
Yeah. So, I mean, the alert is pretty robust in just saying, hey, they're doing misleading things like they have staff wearing white coats to emulate, you know, like they're not medical facilities, but when you go in and see that, you might think, oh, that's a nurse, that's a doctor, because when I go to the doctor, that's what they wear. Mm-hmm. They locate close to abortion clinics, for example, or they have information about abortions on their websites, but they don't offer abortions. They don't offer full spectrum of reproductive health care. Many of these places offer, for example, like a pill to reverse an abortion, but that's something that's not really backed by science or backed by doctors, right? So, you know, AG Mays pointed that out in the alert.
Right. And the stakes have really changed given the new kind of patchwork of laws across America and Arizona. Right now, we have a 15-week abortion ban in place. So one of the things Mays was pointing out, right, is that the clock is ticking and these can delay care, essentially.
Absolutely. And Richie Taylor, a spokesman for the AG's office, told us there's a time clock running on when an abortion can be provided, especially with the 15-week bans currently in place in our state. So anytime that's delayed or missed because of going to a clinic that doesn't actually provide those services can be critical for a woman.
Let's talk about the connection to groups like Turning Point USA, which is where you kind of start the story. They have partnerships with some of these centers and lots of churches, right? This is pretty outwardly religious.
Yes. So the Turning Point connection, they are partnered with Choices Pregnancy Center, which operates three of Arizona's 40-plus crisis pregnancy centers. And, you know, Turning Point USA is very involved, for example, in the Trump campaign and has like this mobilize the vote. They've poured millions of dollars into that. They have, for example, held rallies at Dream City Church. And this is where they announced their partnership with Choices Pregnancy Center. And you've got the guy who runs these, Joshua Chumley, he's on staff at Dream City. So you see this kind of like mix between ideology, absolutely religion, and politics. So it's this kind of big mix, but how it's influencing then this movement.
I wonder, like, from a religious point of view, they're obviously like driven by that in terms of anti-abortion stances. But is there follow-up offering resources for women to carry through a pregnancy or adoption resources, things that could help prevent abortions in that way?
And actually, from my research, certainly a lot of these crisis pregnancy centers do offer that. For example, they'll offer support groups. They offer material assistance in the form of diapers or even classes for first-time parents. You know, what does it look like to be a good parent or how do you nurse? Things like that. Post-abortion support groups. So they do offer assistance, both material assistance and, you know, training, things like that. But a lot of the time it's through these earn while you learn programs, meaning you have to go in, you have to be educated in their ideology, which is often religious. You've got Bible studies, things like that. So again, it's not very straightforward. You're not just going there to pick up diapers. Hmm. There are other things involved.
All right, we'll leave it there. Natasha Yee, investigative reporter for the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting, covering gender politics and policy. Natasha, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Most of the headlines about the U.S. and Mexico may be about the border and immigration these days, but there's another fight going on between us and our neighbors to the south. And it's all about tortillas, or at least the corn that goes into them. Last year, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador banned the use of genetically modified corn in tortillas, which the Mexican people eat a whole lot of. He also phased out the use of the commonly used herbicide glyphosate. The World Health Organization has said it probably causes cancer. But the United States was not happy with this decision, and now the two countries are locked in an official trade dispute over the decision. I spoke all about it with Timothy A. Wise, a senior research fellow at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University. He's author of the book Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food.
The reason he took that action was because there's a lot of concern about the potential health effects of consuming genetically modified corn and the herbicide residues that it comes with, because they're genetically modified in part to tolerate the application of Roundup or glyphosate herbicides. So it was to restrict both the exposure to glyphosate and the exposure to genetically modified traits in their corn. And that is partly because Mexico consumes 10 times the amount of corn that we do in the United States.
Right.
And they consume it not in processed foods like you and I do, mostly in the U.S., but in minimally processed forms like ground corn and tortillas. And that also elevates the risk from exposure.
Right. So you mentioned Roundup there, and some of the concerns I think probably come to people's minds that have been publicized about lawsuits against that particular product. But talk a little bit about what are the health concerns related to this, specifically for people in Mexico who do consume that much?
The concerns, which have now been in the course of this formal dispute process that the United States initiated, there's a raft of published evidence now of the ways in which some genetically modified traits may cause damage to the intestinal tracts of mammals, There's been inadequate testing of a lot of these products. And so what Mexico is saying is we need to take precautions given the amount of corn that we consume and the way we consume it. And the glyphosate residues, as you said, have been the subject of lawsuits, more than 100,000 lawsuits in the United States alone.
Wow.
Those are pretty well documented. They do come in as residues on the crops because, again, what Mexico is eating is just kernels of corn that are ground.
Right.
And if they come straight out of the field and the fields have been sprayed with glyphosate recently, then there are residues on that corn and it gets into the tortillas. And academic studies have actually shown the presence of these transgenic corn varieties and glyphosate in their tortillas.
Interesting. So tell us why the U.S. was not happy about this move. Like, what's the concern from our end?
The concern from our end, depending on who you listen to, is arguing essentially that there is no scientific basis for Mexico to raise these alarms, to raise these concerns. The U.S. has argued all along that Mexico has no science on its side and that the U.S. produces corn that is entirely safe to consume, and the regulations provide adequate safety measures to guarantee that. And because the U.S. exports, and this is why it's a trade dispute, $5 billion worth of corn right now to Mexico and rising levels since the two signed a trade agreement 30 years ago, a lot of U.S. corn goes into Mexico. Very little of it goes into tortillas because we mainly export yellow corn for animal feed. And so one of the things Mexico argues is, why is this a trade dispute? We're not restricting trade and we're not restricting the access to the tortilla chain of much of your corn. U.S. exports, about 3% of our corn exports are white corn.
So tell us more about this official trade dispute and how it works. Like you said, it is kind of like a trial with arguments on both sides from either country. Who decides who's right? Who wins?
There are three arbitrators. There's sort of a list of arbitrators in the trade world who hear these cases. The parties nominated and had to agree or agree to disagree on who the three trade panelists are. It's one Mexican, one person from the U.S., and another from another country. They're not experts in science, generally. They're generally trade lawyers. So this is a stretch for them to kind of make sense of the arguments about the potential risks. But they've done that. I mean, the indications are that they're taking Mexico's claims and evidence very seriously.
So let's talk about the potential consequences here, because this decision will come out at some point here in the next couple of months, it sounds like. If these arbitrators decide in favor of Mexico, does that have any major impacts here in the U.S.?
No, on an actual trade front, it doesn't. I mean, those restrictions have been in place, and U.S. exports of corn to Mexico have soared because there's been a drought in Mexico, and they need the corn for feed. So even though they're not allowing it into tortillas, it's a trivial percentage of what we export. So nobody would notice. There are a few white corn farmers in the United States who grow GM corn who've had to look for other markets. So it would be a very trivial effect on trade if the U.S. loses that case. The real takeaway from this is that we all owe a huge debt of gratitude to Mexico for defending good food, good, clean, healthy food, and bringing to light the inadequacies of the U.S. regulatory process, which allows a lot of unhealthy stuff to get through in order to allow the companies to make their money. And Mexico standing up to the U.S. on this could well come back to us in the form of the U.S. having to come up with better standards.
All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Timothy A. Wise, a senior researcher and fellow at the Global Development and Environment Institute at Tufts University, author of the book Eating Tomorrow, Agribusiness, Family Farmers, and the Battle for the Future of Food. Tim, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for explaining this to us. It's really interesting.
Thanks for having me.
We also reached out to the U.S. Trade Office for comment on this story and did not receive a response.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, Lucinda Williams covers a lot of heavy topics in her music, and sometimes she says she feels like a therapist.
For me, that's a real compliment that, you know, my song can mean something to somebody else. It might not be the exact same way thing that it means to me, but, you know, that's fine. As long as it moves someone, that's all I can ask.
We'll hear more from the prolific songwriter.
But first, there has been a lot of talk this summer about a so-called day zero in Mexico City when the city would run out of water. Much of that conversation has also included warnings about which other cities could face a similar predicament. Day zero has not happened there, but that doesn't mean the region isn't facing serious water problems. We have two perspectives on this today, starting with Caroline Tracy, a geographer and writer. I spoke with her from Mexico City and asked what the water situation has been like for her recently.
Well, there was a lot of talk at the beginning of this summer about a possible day zero, so a day in which one of the city's water systems would cease to provide water, at least for this season and for the foreseeable future. The rains have been pretty good this summer, so it seems like the day zero possibility has been pushed back, but that doesn't mean that there hasn't been pretty strict water rationing in Mexico City. It varies by neighborhood. So there is definitely a justice component where, you know, more well-to-do neighborhoods will have less water rationing, and neighborhoods that are more peripheral will sometimes just lose service altogether. Where I live, which is my partner who is from here's apartment, is kind of a central but working class neighborhood. And so the type of rationing that we've seen has been that there'll be periods of weeks where there is water service for part of the day, one day, and then no water service for a day or two, and then partial water service for another day, kind of on a rotation like that. That I would say the month of July was sort of the most extreme rationing. And the other kind of phenomenon that has been very noticeable is that there's a lot more water trucking going on.
So what has that rationing meant for you and your neighbors? Like, how have you had to change the way you go about your days and go about your lives?
There's an interesting set of routines that you develop. I think, you know, there's sort of a sound that you hear when the water pump in your building starts to bring water up to the tanks that are on the top of the building. So you'll sometimes just hear this buzz start, and it sort of launches you into, you know, the routine, which involves filling buckets so that you have water that you can use to wash the dishes or flush the toilet, that kind of thing. I think probably many people around the city have these buckets in their shower that are kind of the reserve buckets for when the water goes out.
So do you get the sense that people are using less water now with this rationing, or they may be just using the same amount of water over more time?
It's a good question. I think that probably, you know, each household and each family adjusts in a slightly different way. And I think it's also important to point out that there are areas of Mexico City that really have consistent water shortages.
So what lessons do you think those of us in the American Southwest might be able to learn from the experience of Mexico City and, you know, the water shortages there and how that's affected people?
Well, I think there are some really interesting connections in terms of the geology and hydrology of Mexico and the Mexico Basin and the Southwest and the way that we get water in the Southwest. One of the sort of most fundamental is just the type of basin that Mexico City is in. It's a closed basin. So instead of a valley, it's like more like a bowl. Everyone calls it the Valley of Mexico, but it's a misnomer. So when you see the official documents from the city, from the Irrigation Commission or the Hydrology Commission, they say the basin of the Valley of Mexico, which is sort of redundant. but that geologic formation is very similar to, for instance, Salt Lake City. So you have this very clear parallel between the sort of dried up lake at the base of the Mexico Basin and the Great Salt Lake in Salt Lake City.
What might all of this mean for a place like Arizona, which, you know, like parts of Mexico, rely on, in some places, groundwater, some places, surface water? There's obviously Colorado River water at play here. What kind of parallels might you be looking at between a place like Arizona and what's currently happening in Mexico City?
I think there's an important parallel in terms of where we in the Southwest in Arizona get our water and what's going on in Mexico City, which is that in Tucson, for instance, it's a mix of groundwater and Colorado River water, so Central Arizona Project water. And Mexico City has a similar mix, where it's about 60% groundwater and then about 20% from a system they call Cuitzamala, which is coming water that comes from a different basin. And so that's essentially the same concept as the Central Arizona Project, where water does flow uphill, right? There's this very energy intensive system of aqueducts and pumps that brings water from Lake Havasu to Tucson or to Phoenix also. And there are these sort of interbasin systems around the Southwest, and there are more on the table. So I think both thinking critically about groundwater and the rapidity with which we are using up a resource without sufficiently recharging it, and also the intense engineering required to do these interbasin transfers and bring water from a faraway basin to another basin, are similarities between Mexico City and the American Southwest.
Yeah. What have the conversations been like in and around Mexico City in terms of trying to figure out a solution to this? Because I would imagine that, you know, you and your neighbors would not be thrilled for, you know, into the foreseeable future to only have water certain days a week.
I think that it's definitely a topic of conversation. It did come up in the presidential debate, but it's one that still continues to be without a clear resolution. One problem that Mexico City has that I think is not out of the question for the American Southwest is that the water that falls on the basin all sort of drains to the lowest point. So if you can picture the Great Salt Lake, it's essentially the same concept. There was a lake that was drained to build the city. And so in the same way that the water in Utah drains to the Great Salt Lake, the water drains around Mexico City. But to avoid flooding, they built a drain. They built a tunnel out of the valley. And the problem with that is that it means that the groundwater does not get recharged. So when you have a place where it rains or snows significantly, and in Mexico City it does rain significantly, it rains like 150% more than it rains in London, You want to recharge the groundwater so you can continue using it. And that is something that does not happen here because the water gets drained out through this tunnel. And so I think one thing that we need to be thinking about both in the Southwest and in Mexico City is how do we recharge groundwater? And I think that's a very kind of active field for people that want to go into hydrology and water management is thinking about how best to do this.
All right. That is writer Caroline Tracy speaking from Mexico City. Caroline, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you.
As Caroline referenced, there have been cutbacks in the water supplies in certain parts of Mexico City. And as my next guest explains, that's not necessarily a surprise. Dean Shaheem is a professor of environmental studies at New York University, where he studies the water crisis in Mexico City. When I caught up with him recently, I asked if day zero was a legitimate possibility.
No, that's kind of, unfortunately, sort of it makes a good headline, but it's not really the story. What's going on is that Mexico City, the sort of metropolitan region, I'm going to really talk about the whole metro region of 22 mm-hmm. million people. They depend on basically two main sources of water. One is imported water and one is local water from the groundwater aquifer. And of that imported water, the majority of it comes from this Cuitzamala system, which is an aqueduct that connects the city to a series of dams, reservoirs, which are quite far away from the city, and the water's pumped up nearly half a mile. And that system of reservoirs is what's really in crisis right now because of climate change. As we know, you know, rains have become quite uneven, and this year has been a particularly bad year in terms of filling the reservoirs. And so the engineers who managed that system in the Federal Water Ministry started to really throttle down the amount of water and warn the population that there were going to have to be serious cutbacks in the amount of water that they bring to the city from those reservoirs, because they don't want them to go to zero. And so the day zero was basically their projection of when they would have to almost cut off the supply to the city, which would be a real problem because it is about 30% of the supply of water to the entire metropolitan regions. But again, it's 30%. It's not the entire water source. It's not like nobody would have water. It would just be certain areas of the city that are more dependent on that system based on the way the pipes work would be in particular crisis, but other parts might feel like there was almost nothing happening. So it's kind of a very uneven problem. But the reason why this became such a media story, really, I think, is that suddenly the areas where most people with money and also some foreign journalists live were the ones that were suddenly facing much more of the water cutbacks than they're used to.
How severe could the cutbacks within that 30% of the supply be? Like, could they be shut off altogether? Or are we just looking at less than what folks are used to?
I'm not sure if it would be cut off completely. I don't think so. I think they would basically bring it down. I mean, it depends basically on whether or not it continued to rain or didn't rain at all. I think they would kind of have to make those decisions as, you know, they'd make on a day-to-day basis.
So for the other 70%, you kind of alluded to the fact that, you know, folks who get their water from that supply might not notice there's much going on. Like, are there any cutbacks in that supply, or is that pretty much as is?
No, there have been cutbacks all over. And the reason why is because Mexico City has a very well-developed, unfortunately, system of water tanker trucks. And so they have these water tanker trucks fill up at wells, usually, around the city, and then they redistribute that water to other, they can kind of go to businesses, they go to neighborhoods, they go to people's houses directly, and they will refill people's water cisterns, which is, because of the irregular water supply, something that people are quite used to, many buildings have. And so these are underground storage tanks for water, and so they'll refill these underground storage tanks, or if people don't have them, their water barrels or whatever they have to store water in. And so that is a kind of above the ground redistribution that happens. And that means that also engineers who are managing and throttling the supply with their valves all throughout the system, you know, they might give more priority to filling those water tanker trucks such that they can spread out the water more evenly. They also might give priority based on politics too. I mean, which areas, many, you know, you might have a rich neighborhood next to a poor neighborhood and they depend on the same wells. And so if that rich neighborhood also overall that area is getting maybe say a part of its water usually comes from this Cutzamala aqueduct, if they're facing a cutback overall, you know, they don't have to cut back both neighborhoods equally. You know, there's a way in which, depending on the geography of where the valves are, et cetera, that they can kind of give certain neighborhoods priority over others. And so people are definitely feeling the cutbacks all over, but there are places in which people haven't felt it at all.
What does the water usage over time look like? I mean, are people using the same amount of water they've used in years and decades past? Has it gone down, up?
I think it's been quite steady. In fact, if anything, I imagine it's gone down. I think just out of necessity because people don't have as much water. And so there are certain areas in which people are using, you know, the wealthy areas use a lot of water. I mean, the per capita use of water is radically different in the western part of the city that's wealthier versus the eastern part, which is poorer. And people in the eastern part of the city are very well versed in recycling every last drop of water. Whereas in the western part of the city where most tourists would go to, you know, they have swimming pools. People don't even notice. Everything seems fine. So there's a lot more profligate use of water in those areas. By necessity, people have had to use less. I mean, if you just think about the fact that the population has grown by this amount, by millions of people again, and the water supply has been the same, there, you know, by definition, there has to have been actually a decline in water and per capita water usage. But again, it's very uneven. And so the poor, generally speaking, are the ones who are suffering the most here.
All of that makes it kind of hard to see what the solution is here, or if there is a solution here. I mean, are there ways for Mexico City to either conserve enough water or to get water from other sources to try to solve this problem?
You know, I think the solutions people have been proposing really for more than, you know, I'm definitely not the first person to suggest anything here. So the solutions have been well known for a long time. I mean, things like rainwater catchment. There's been a lot of progress on that. I want to say that's one bright spot. People doing rainwater, because again, something that's different perhaps for your listeners, you know, unlike Phoenix or the Southwest, Mexico City is not an arid place at all, actually, you know, and so it's quite even more ironic. It's a place that floods constantly because it has so much rain. And so there is a real possibility for catching, you know, doing rainwater catchment off people's roofs, off the buildings, and filling those cisterns with that treated rainwater. And so that's something that the government has been pushing and I think could be expanded. There's also been attempts and lots of pilot projects at things like groundwater injection. That means getting water, treating it, and then pumping it into the aquifer rather than just pulling it out. And that could kind of be a storage, a way to store water in between rains and actually then use it, pump it back out for drinking. There's also been attempts to restore rivers and lakes. I mean, there have been small attempts. It's just, it's a matter of actually giving the kind of really capital that you that's required to make these into much bigger programs. And so I think that I'm a little bit optimistic. The new mayor who's just been elected, she is saying good things, whether or not actually she is able to do them. And she's mentioned some of the things I just said. You know, that remains to be seen.
All right. That is Dean Shaheem, a professor of environmental studies at New York University. Dean, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Travel and tourism have been big industries in the Phoenix area for decades. Visitors from the East Coast or Midwest have headed to the Valley looking for something different or maybe just some sunshine. We're exploring the history and future of resorts and the Valley as a resort community in a series called Last Resorts. To do that, we're traveling from Paradise Valley to Litchfield Park, visiting some of the Valley's oldest and newest resorts, and hearing how they've impacted the region from art and architecture to how people all over the world view the West.
From all over the world, come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix, a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
In this series, we've been looking at Phoenix's past and present as a resort town and the ways in which people were drawn to this fast-growing sunny city. Joining me today is the show's senior producer, Sativa Peterson, who dove into Arizona's historic newspapers and documents to talk about another early draw to the Valley, health and wellness. Good morning, Sativa.
Good morning, Mark.
Hope you're feeling well.
So, I am. Thank you. Yeah, it turns out, you know, health and wellness played a very important role in Phoenix's origins as a resort town. And of course, climate was a key factor in all of this, which we'll get to in just a second. But first, let's do a quick catch up. In this series, we've already mentioned how the construction of the highway system across the United States played an important role in the growing tourism industry in Phoenix.
Right. We learned that by the 1930s, for example, Van Buren Street in Phoenix was at the crossroads for four federal highways, the US 60, 70, 80, and 89.
Yeah, that's correct. So even before that, there was an earlier technological achievement that brought waves of visitors to our state, and that was the arrival of transcontinental train service in Arizona, which began in the late 1870s and early 80s. And it really didn't take long before there were multiple passenger trains a day passing through Phoenix. You had the Southern Pacific, the M&P, which stood for the Maricopa and Phoenix Railroad, and the Santa Fe.
And Sativa, I imagine these early travelers were anticipating getting away from the snow and cold of the East and Midwest and heading somewhere where maybe there was some sunshine.
That was a big part of it. And very early on, we start to see sunshine being equated with health and wellness. I found a pamphlet published in 1899 called Arizona Health Resorts. It was published by the passenger department of the Santa Fe Railroad, and I'm just going to read it to you.
Okay.
It said, quote, "Are your lungs weak? Have you a troublesome cough? If thus afflicted, try the climate cure, which consists of taking up one's residence in a place where the air is dry, pure, and warm. Nature is the best of physicians when conditions are friendly."
Hmm.
Yeah. So weather and good health tied together early on. Now, around the same time as transcontinental rail travel is becoming a reality, tuberculosis was hitting the country very hard. It was the second leading cause of death in the U.S. in 1900. So All across the Midwest and East Coast, you know, hometown doctors are recommending to their patients with lung problems that, hey, maybe you should head to Arizona to recover. And so with that, and because of the rail service, people start to flock to Phoenix as a therapeutic destination.
Well, so there must have been a need for places for all those people to stay. Was Phoenix set up for that?
Well, yeah, we have some examples of that. So some people, if they could afford it, stayed in sanitariums. But these were, you know, could be almost luxurious to some extent. So many people were looking for an alternative to that, and they started wintering at what were rustic health camps in what is now Scottsdale. One of these was Graves Guest Ranch. This is operating around 1910s. It was located in the northwest corner of Indian School and Scottsdale Roads, and it catered to visitors and folks who would come to the dry Arizona climate to restore their health. And we start seeing mentions of people coming to Arizona in newspapers printed all across the country, you know, from towns in Iowa and Arkansas, North Dakota, Wisconsin. So at the Graves Guest Ranch, people were staying in structures that were pretty simple, really a wood frame that was covered in canvas. And this was also happening in the Sunny Slope area. There were encampments, more people living in tent houses and rudimentary cottages. And there were so many health seekers, in fact, that that's one of the things that helped Arizona reach its population in order to achieve statehood.
Really?
Yeah. So you start seeing people staying at the Graves Guest Ranch. But as you can imagine, people afflicted with, you know, tuberculosis, it was a highly contagious disease. And, you know, to be honest, some of them were not always welcomed here. So I've got an example of how this plays into our resort history.
Well, let's hear that. What is it?
Well, we see our first real luxury resort in the Phoenix area, which is Castle Hot Springs, which opened back in 1896. So this is this long, you know, continuum we're going to see of how health and wellness play into our resorts. But it built itself as a pleasure and a health resort of the highest class, well known for its hot mineral waters and glorious climate. Ads start appearing for Castle Hot Springs Hotel in the Arizona Republican as early as 1906. And there was some interesting language. One ad claimed, quote, "No cases of tuberculosis or other infectious diseases will be received. This is for the safety of the other guests, and because diseases of this class are not benefited by drinking the waters, they're actually injured by taking the baths." So there's this baked-in tension. You know, we even see class mentioned. And so there's almost this assumption that tuberculosis could be contained, you know, and that they could kind of keep it out.
So, Sativa, were you able to find any other examples of health and wellness being used as a draw for people to the Valley?
Yes. Now, stay with me because this is going to be a bit of a hard pivot.
Okay.
So, eventually, you know, the tuberculosis epidemic does come to an end in the late 1940s, and antibiotics are developed, and by the mid-1950s, it's really diminished. So, one of my favorite places is the Main Chance Resort, which opened at the southeast base of Camelback Mountain in 1947. The Main Chance was the second location of the destination spa created by cosmetics and wellness, you know, mogul Elizabeth Arden.
Okay.
She first opened a Main Chance in Mount Vernon, Maine in 1934. And now this location was going to be, you know, a desert location for the wealthy and glamorous where they could winter. And the Main Chance was luxurious. It was ladies only. It offered everything from makeup lessons and manicures to exercise classes and swimming. So this resort promises rest, beauty, weight loss. Most visitors were restricted to a 900 calorie a day diet. So we see this whole trend, this continuation, you know, of people coming to the desert for cures, in a sense.
Well, so Sativa, as visitors continue to increase, obviously so did the number of resorts in the Valley. Spa services are now common amenity along with fitness classes and fine dining. Is there a through line there from what you've been talking about to the kinds of amenities that people come to resorts for now?
I really think so. I think we can draw a line between people coming out, you know, in the 1880s, 1890s for curative treatments, for sun, for health, to even how we see the inclusion of health and wellness treatments at spas today. And it seems like, you know, these ideas around health and wellness were really an essential element of city building here in Phoenix.
Interesting. All right. That is the show's Sativa Peterson. Sativa, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Across a career spanning over four decades, singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams has built a reputation as one of America's most hallowed bards. Her songs of hard drinking, hard living, and hard-earned redemption have earned her numerous Grammy nominations and awards. Two of her records appear on Rolling Stone's list of the 500 best albums of all time. And Time magazine once called her America's best songwriter. So how does she do it? Well, as she told the show's Sam Dingman, it's not a career path for the faint of heart.
I think I wrote my first song when I was about 14, maybe. And it was pretty innocent.
Uh-huh.
It was called The Wind Blows, and it was just like this little folk song sounding thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, the wind blows, and it blows through the town, and the people in the town hear it blow. The wind blows, and it blows through the town, uh-huh. and the people in the town hear it blow. It sounds like something a six-year-old would write, you know.
Sure.
But that was my, you know, first attempt at trying my hand at songwriting, and obviously over the years it progressed.
Yes. Well, it's funny that you used the word innocent to describe it, because that's maybe not an adjective that I think a lot of people would use to describe a Lucinda Williams song. You've written songs about some very hard things over the years.
Yeah. I don't know. It just appealed to me.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought, you know, I want to write about something besides unrequited love. And my father, who was a big influence on me that way, was writing poetry, and he would write about all kinds of subjects, from a wreck on the highway to a cat sleeping in the windowsill.
Uh-huh.
Some of his stuff was pretty hard-edged.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I want to dig deeper, you know,
yeah,
like he did.
That must have been a really powerful experience to have him signal to you that it's all fair game. Like, you're allowed to write about this stuff.
Exactly. Yes. That's exactly the word, allowed. You know, because for some people, they kind of set rules for themselves. You know, like, you can't really write about this because it might upset people too much. And
yeah.
And I did have a lot of different kinds of feedback. People would say things like, your songs are too dark. I remember this one woman came up to me one night after a show and said, I can't listen to that one particular song. And, you know, she didn't say why. She just said, it was too intense for some, you know, and I realized, okay, it pushes a button in her somewhere. But, you know, I can't help that. I mean, that's something she has to go through by herself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry I'm the one to kind of push the button, but...
Yeah. Sometimes people need the button pushed.
Exactly. Yeah, they don't know they do, though, usually.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyway, yeah, sometimes I felt like I was a therapist and a songwriter.
I think you have been for a lot of people.
You know, I mean, for me, that's a real compliment that, you know, my song can mean something to somebody else. I mean, it might not be the exact same way thing that it means to me, but you know, that's fine. As long as it moves someone, that's all I can ask.
When you're writing a song, is there a standard you hold yourself to in terms of whether it has to move you in order to want to record it and put it out there? Like, how do you know it's how do you know it's worth writing about?
It's hard to describe in words. The emotion gets so strong, I feel like I'm going to cry.
Yeah.
And that's when I know I'm really reached a part of myself. Like, it needs to reach in a deep place in me. So it's very therapeutic, songwriting.
Yeah. In order to provide that therapy for other people, you have to provide it for yourself first.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was performing with some other musicians one night in Nashville at this little venue, and this guy came up to me who was He said, I'm just starting to learn how to write songs, and I want to ask you some questions about it. And I said, okay. So I sat down with him, and he said, how do I do it? You know, what do you do? What do you do? Something like that. You know, what's your secret?
Uh-huh.
And the best I could think of was, I said, you have to be willing and able to go dig down into the darkest recesses of your soul.
Yeah.
And he looked at me after I said that and he said, I don't think I can do that. I don't know if I can do that. You know, and it was, I felt so sad, you know, yeah. I just wanted to hug him, but he was being real when he said that. He said, I just don't know if I can do that. And I think, I don't know if I said anything, but I think I was thinking, well, I don't know what to tell you then. You're not going to,
yeah,
you're going to have a hard time being a songwriter if you're not able to do that.
Yeah. That's such an interesting moment because, I mean, it strikes me that in that moment, you're both being incredibly honest with each other, you know?
Yeah. And the thing is, I didn't want to let him down or disappoint him.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to get there, but he knew himself well enough to know he was going to have a hard time, you know, digging into the deep fathoms of his subconscious or, you know, whatever it is to be able to bring a song up to the surface.
Well, let me ask you, you know, when you sit down to write a song, and I've heard you say that you tend to start with lyrics. What do you find comes to you first? Because I think of your songwriting as very scenic, to make the most obvious Lucinda Williams reference ever, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. Do you find that you go to those scenic details first, or do you sit down to try to capture a feeling and the specifics of the scenes that go with that feeling come to you later?
I think I start with certain phrases maybe that come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember when I was working on Car Wheels, it was really weird because I would go to sleep and right as I was waking up, I would have this phrase in my head, in my mind, sitting in the kitchen, a house in Macon, Loretta singing on the radio, smell of coffee, eggs and bacon, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road.
Yeah.
And I would wake up and write it down. And, you know, this kind of process went on for a while.
So it's like that phrase or those lines, you can tell that they're attached to something. You just kind of don't know what it is yet.
You don't know what it is yet. And you just have to have faith that it's in there. You just have to, you've got to pull it out somehow.
So,
there's a lot of trial and error involved.
Yeah, absolutely.
And frustration.
Is it the melody sometimes that helps you find the emotion that is attached to the phrase you've come up with? Like,
yes.
Because I could imagine if you have a phrase that feels meaningful to you, but you don't know why, I could imagine singing it a couple different ways and that the melody would sort of help unlock whatever's behind it.
That's it.
How do you experience it when you know the melody that you've found is right? Is it that sense you're talking about of it almost makes you cry?
That's when I know, you know, I go, okay, I'm onto something here. Kind of a crazy process. It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, my father, one of my favorite poems of his was called Compassion. And the strongest line in it towards the end of the poem is, have compassion for everyone you meet. Who knows what wars are going on down there where the spirit meets the bone.
Hmm.
That's the deep recesses of, you know, that I'm talking about, where the spirit meets the bone. It doesn't get any deeper than that.
Sitting in the kitchen, a house in Macon, Loretta singing on the radio. Smell of coffee, eggs and bacon, car wheels on a gravel road.
Well, Lucinda Williams, thank you so much for this conversation.
You're welcome.
Lucinda Williams and her band will be at the Mesa Arts Center tomorrow night.
Come on now, child, we're gonna go for a ride, car wheels on a gravel road.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.
Can't find a day.